The Demilitarized Zone, South Korea. Hyung Chol Choi, deputy director of the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, gestures to the dry, hilly, unremarkable landscape to our north. One might mistake it for Southern California, if not for the deserted pillboxes, fading banners, and rusting barbed wire fence that runs to either horizon. What happened? No one knows. No country was better prepared to repel the infestation than North Korea. Rivers to the north, oceans to the east and west, and to the south, he gestures to the demilitarized zone, the most heavily fortified border on Earth. You can see how mountainous the terrain is, how easily defensible. But what you can't see is that those mountains are honeycombed with a titanic military-industrial infrastructure. The North Korean government learned some very hard lessons from your bombing campaign of the 1950s, and had been laboring ever since to create a subterranean system that would allow their people to wage another war from a secure location. Their population was heavily militarized, marshaled to a degree of readiness that made Israel look like Iceland. Over 1 million men and women were actively under arms, with a further 5 in reserve. That is over 1/4 of the entire population, not to mention the fact that almost everyone in the country had, at some point in their lives, undergone basic military training. More important than this training, though, and most important for this kind of warfare, was an almost superhuman degree of national discipline. North Koreans were indoctrinated from birth to believe that their lives were meaningless, that they existed only to serve the state, the revolution, and the great leader. This is almost the polar opposite of what we experienced in the South. We were an open society. We had to be. International trade was our lifeblood. We were individualists. Maybe not as much as you Americans, but we had more than our share of protests and public disturbances. We were such a free and fractured society that we barely managed to implement the Chang Doctrine during the Great Panic. Note 1. The Chang Doctrine, South Korea's version of the Redeker Plan. End note. That kind of internal crisis would have been inconceivable in the North. They were a people who, even when their government caused a near-genocidal famine, would rather resort to eating children than raise even a whisper of defiance. Note 2. There have been reports of alleged cannibalism during the famine of 1992, and that some of the victims were children. End note. This was the kind of subservience Adolf Hitler could have only dreamed of. If you had given each citizen a gun, a rock, or even their bare hands, pointed them at approaching zombies and said, "Fight," they would have done so down to the oldest woman and smallest tot. This was a country bred for war, planned, prepared, and poised for it since July 27, 1953. If you were going to invent a country to not only survive but triumph over the apocalypse we faced, it would have been the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. So what happened? About 1 month before our troubles started, before the first outbreaks were reported in Busan, the North suddenly and inexplicably severed all diplomatic relations. We weren't told why the rail line, the only overland link to see long-lost relatives in the north, had their dreams abruptly shattered by a rubber stamp. No explanation of any kind was given. All we got was their standard matter-of-state security brush-off. Unlike many others, I wasn't convinced that this was a prelude to war. Whenever the North had threatened violence, they always rang the same bells. No satellite data, ours or the Americans, showed any hostile intent. There were no troop movements, no aircraft fueling, no ship or submarine deployment. If anything, our forces along the demilitarized zone began noticing their opposite numbers disappearing. We knew them all, the border troops. We'd photographed each one over the years, given them nicknames like Snake Eyes or Bulldog. even compiled dossiers on their supposed ages, backgrounds, and personal lives. Now they were gone, vanished behind shielded trenches and dugouts. Our seismic indicators were similarly silent. If the North had begun tunneling operations, or even massed vehicles on the other side of Z, we would have heard it, like the National Opera Company. Panmunjom is the only area along the DMZ where opposing sides can meet for face-to-face negotiations. We share joint custody of the conference rooms, and our troops posture for each other over several meters of open courtyard. The guards were changed on a rotating basis. One night, as the North Korean detachment marched into their barracks, no replacement unit marched out. The doors were shut, the lights were extinguished, and we never saw them again. We also saw a complete halt to human intelligence infiltration. Spies from the North were almost as regular and predictable as the seasons. Most of the time they were easy to spot, wearing out-of-date clothes or asking the price of goods that they should have already known. We used to pick them up all the time, but since the outbreaks began, their numbers had dwindled to zero.
What about your spies in the North?
Vanished, all of them. Right about the same time, all our electronic surveillance assets went dark. I don't mean there was no disturbing radio traffic. I mean there was no traffic at all. One by one, all the civilian and military channels began shutting down. Satellite images showed fewer farmers in their fields, less foot traffic in city streets, even fewer volunteer laborers on many public works projects, which is something that has never happened before. Before we knew it, there wasn't a living soul left from the Yalu to the DMZ. From a purely intelligence standpoint, it appeared as if the entire country, every man, woman, and child in North Korea, had simply vanished. This mystery only stoked our growing anxiety, given what we had to deal with at home. By now, there were outbreaks in Seoul, Pohang, Tadjon. There was the evacuation of Mokpo, the isolation of Kangnung, and, of course, our version of Yonkers at Incheon. And all of it compounded by the need to keep at least half our active divisions along our northern border. Too many in the Ministry of National Defense were convinced that Pyongyang was just aching for war, waiting eagerly for our darkest moment to come thundering across the 38th parallel. We in the intelligence community couldn't disagree more. We kept telling them that if they were waiting for our darkest hour, then that hour had most certainly arrived. Tahan-min-guk was on the brink of national collapse. Plans were being secretly drafted for a Japanese-style resettlement. Covert teams were already scouting locations in Kamchatka. If the Chang Doctrine hadn't worked, if just a few more units had broken, if a few more safe zones had collapsed, maybe we owe our survival to the North, or at least to the fear of it. My generation never really saw the North as a threat. I'm speaking of the civilians, you understand. Those of my age who saw them as a backward, starving, failed nation. My generation had grown up their entire lives in peace and prosperity. The only thing they feared was a German-style reunification that would bring millions of homeless ex-communists looking for a handout. That wasn't the case with those who came before us, our parents and grandparents, those who lived with the very real specter of invasion hanging over them, the knowledge that at any moment the alarms might sound, the lights might dim, and the bankers, school teachers, and taxi drivers might be called to pick up arms and fight to defend their homeland. Their hearts and minds were ever vigilant, and in the end, it was them, not us, who rallied the national spirit. I'm still pushing for an expedition to the North. I'm still blocked at every turn. There's too much work to do, they tell me. The country is still in shambles. We also have our international commitments, most importantly, the repatriation of our refugees to Kyushu. Snorts.
Those Japs are gonna owe us big time. I'm not asking for a recon in force. Just give me one helicopter, one fishing boat. Just open the gates at Panmunjom and let me walk through on foot. What if you trigger some booby trap, they counter? What if it's nuclear? What if you open the door to some underground city and 23 million zombies come spewing out? Their arguments aren't without merit. We know the DMZ is heavily mined. Last month, a cargo plane nearing their airspace was fired on by a surface-to-air missile. The launcher was an automated model, the type they'd designed as a revenge weapon in case the population had already been obliterated. Conventional wisdom is that they must have evacuated to their subterranean complexes. If that is true, then our estimates of the size and depth of those complexes were grossly inaccurate. Maybe the entire population is underground, tooling away on endless war projects, while their great leader continues to anesthetize himself with Western liquor and American pornography. Do they even know the war is over? Have their leaders lied to them again and told them that the world as they know it has ceased to be? Maybe the rise of the dead was a good thing in their eyes, an excuse to tighten the yoke even further in a society built on blind subjugation. The great leader always wanted to be a living god, and now, as master not only of the food his people eat, the air they breathe, but the very light of their artificial suns, maybe his twisted fantasy has finally become a reality. Maybe that was the original plan, but something went disastrously wrong. Look what happened to the mole city underneath Paris. What if that occurred in the north on a national level? Maybe those caverns are teeming with 23 million zombies, emaciated automatons howling in the darkness and just waiting to be unleashed.